Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fucksters? What the fucking avians? This is Mark Maron. That's me. Did I mention Vince Gilligan is on the show today? Vince Gilligan, the creator of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Breaking Bad, arguably the best fucking television show ever. I've never been so compelled and engaged in a TV show in my life. I miss it. There's shows I miss The Sopranos. I miss The Wire and Breaking Bad now. But I've been watching Better Call Saul, which is Vince's new show, which is also amazing. Bob Odenkirk is doing an incredible job in the acting department, as is Michael McKean and the supporting cast. But he's a genius in my mind, and I was nervous to talk to him. I didn't do any real research around how he talked or even what he looked like necessarily before he came over, and I was nervous. Like I was nervous when I met Paul Thomas Anderson, because these guys in my mind are fucking geniuses, and I thought he'd be some dark wizard, but he's just a pleasant, smart, polite Southern dude. Had a great conversation. I love meeting people who I think are wizards, and they're humble and human and just great to talk to. So Vince Gilligan, that's today. It's going to happen momentarily. All right. Okay. Also, before I forget, tonight on Marin on IFC, me and my old friend, Sam Cedar, co-star. I made good on it. All right. Me and Sam go way back. There's a very exciting, tense, aggravated comedic dynamic, and it's a very fun show. Sam comes out to help me with the patent troll problem. And then it just gets kooky. It's funny. It's funny to see us together, and I had a great time. That's at 10 o'clock tonight on IFC. Me and Sam Cedar on the new Marin. Okay? Dave Anthony's there, too. All right? Dave Anthony's there. He'll be there. Okay? He's there being creepy. All right. So I just need to say that because sometimes I forget to plug my own show. Okay. Done. Oh, somebody asked for me to give you a cat update. I forget that there's ongoing narratives in my life that I just leave hanging. And I do have some updates. I do have some updates on the cats. Monkey, this is really when you know that you're too entrenched in the cats, in the cat world, in cat life. Last night, Sarah was over, the painter, and we're about to go to sleep, and something smells. And I thought, you know, sadly, for a moment, I thought it might be my balls because I hadn't showered in a couple days. And I'm sorry if that's too much information, but, you know, guys, you know, you pick up a little, you sweat a lot, it's hot out, either my armpit. I just thought it was me. How is that better? Can we just put it that way? And then, you know, I'd eaten some ceviche, so it was a bad combination, you know. So I thought a mixture of the fish and the balls and, you know, my sweat, and I blame myself. Now, there's been a cat pee smell problem in the house in my bedroom for a while, and I just haven't been able to track it. I knew it was by the hamper. I didn't know if Monkey was peeing on the hamper, around the hamper, but last night it became very clear that Monkey was peeing on the curtains, somehow skillfully in the corner of the room and on the curtains. Now, this might be because Scaredy Cat, the wild feral, might be shitting and peeing under my house, right under my bedroom. So Monkey's picking up that smell and he decides that's a good place to go. Because usually cats, they start doing that shit when they don't feel well. But Monkey's never seemed better. He's eating. He's got energy. He's excited. He's very warm. He's a nice cat. But he's just peeing in my bedroom. I've been sleeping in a room that smells like cat piss for months. And Sarah has like 8 or 9 cats that she feeds. She has cats in her life. They're all wild, most of them. But we're just like, we're those people. Like we couldn't track it. It wasn't bothersome enough for us to fucking track it. And then there was this other smell, which I assumed was me. And I woke up at 5:30 in the morning obsessed. I had to get rid of the curtains. I had to like clean down everything. I got to go buy some of that, you know, don't pee here spray. But then I found some fucking cat shit, fresh cat shit behind the hamper. I blame myself. I mean, could I have possibly smelled like, you know, months worth of cat urine and a fresh cat shit? Like, I blame my balls for that. That's ridiculous. I mean, I know that, you know, humans smell, but nonetheless, some heavy cleaning went down. Some curtains had to go. The hamper's got to go. I had to do some cleaning of the floor. I got to figure out what's going on. I don't know. I do think that window where the hamper is and that area is the only place that monkey sees the cats outside. And that's a fine transition to the cats outside. Scaredy cat, the striped cat, the wild cat, whose face was ripped up at one point in time, but has survived about a decade now. I've been feeding this cat. He's fine. He's around. He's fat. It's nice when the wild cats get fat. Big head, the big-headed black cat with the huge balls, he's still around, still got a big head. We got to trap him and get him fixed because God knows what he's done out there with the ladies. He comes around. He doesn't seem to know when to hiss or meow. Like he's seen, it's one of the only cats I've ever met that hisses when he's happy to see you. It's a confusing thing. He's a little nuts. He hisses, he meows, but he's excited. He's around. He looks lean. His head is huge. Balls are huge. Frame tight. Nice cat, though. Clearly somebody's cat who is neglecting him. Deaf black cat, the hero, the mystic, the true survivor, the warrior, back around. I see him hanging out. I watched him approach the bowl last night. Now, for those of you who are just listening to the show, I've had a relationship with this cat on and off for a few years now. It's a wild cat. Can't hear a fucking thing. Nothing. Deaf as fuck. And lives out there among coyotes and other wild cats and disappears for months at a time. And right when I think he's gone, he's dead. How could he not be? He's deaf. Boom. There he is on the deck cleaning himself. It takes a lot for him to approach the bowl. Because he's got to fight skunks. There's one baby skunk left of a skunk litter out there that seems to be lingering. He was abandoned. I guess this is his neighborhood. I don't know how skunks work. Also, a side note. Thank you for all the information about birds, about those junky birds that are hijacking my hummingbird feeder. I believe we're going with hooded oriole. A lot of emails and tweets with pictures. Seems to me an ornithologist, is that what they are? Is that the right one? The birds, ornithologist, is that it? I'm going to go with that because I'm not going to Google anything. I hope that's right and that's not like some sort of specific type of cancer doctor. Hooded oriole, I think you're right. Hooded oriole, bad word for me with my rolling L's and my inability to say R's or S's. Phew, is it too late for speech therapy? Vince Gilligan, just a few minutes. I did want to share something with you, can I? Can I share something with you? I don't know when one becomes funny. I know that I was pretty funny and disruptive in school, but I don't know if I was always funny. You know, I know I was a somewhat sensitive kid. I know I was a gregarious kid, precocious even, annoying to adults. But my father's sister, Linda, my Aunt Linda, who I don't see that side of the family much, they live down the Jersey Shore, and I'm not that in touch with them, which is sad, but it's my fault. They came to see me at the Red Bank show in Jersey, and she sent me a couple emails afterwards, and I hadn't talked to her in a long time, and you know, I love them. They're my cousins and my aunt, but I just don't see them. I'm detached. I'm not as connected to family as some other people are, or perhaps that I should be, but she shared these two these two stories that I will share with you. This is very old material. This is very old Mark Maron material, and these are emails from my Aunt Linda. Dear Mark, do you remember when my parents lived in a two-family house in Jersey City? That would be my grandparents, obviously. The Olgin family lived upstairs, and we could hear them going up and down the stairs. You were about three, and you would ask what the noise was. Your grandma and grandpa would say, "It's the Olgins." One day, the Olgins stopped by to say hello. When you were introduced, you exclaimed joyfully, "The Olgins are people!" I always smile when I remember that story. You never know what kids are thinking, love, Linda. The Olgins are people. Solid tag. Solid tag. I told her I love that story, so she sent me another one. Dear Mark, do you also remember your grandma and grandpa buying you tickets to the circus in New York every year? You were scared of the clowns. Then one day you asked them if they loved you. They said that they certainly did. Then you asked them, then why do you keep taking me to the circus? Boom! You were certainly a lovable little guy. Solid tags. Man. So, you know what? Had I known, I would have just started writing comedy then. Had I known. I'm very proud of those stories, and I'm glad that she sent them along. I didn't know I was afraid of clowns. I think that when people are afraid of clowns, from far away, clowns are okay, but it's when you see them up close and you can see the person inside the makeup. Like, you can just see the human eyes and some of the wrinkles under the clown makeup. You know, just the whatever, you know, sad life led them behind that makeup, or you assume that. But it's, I think what really is the fundamentally frightening thing about clowns is that when they get close enough that you can see the whites of their eyes and the human heart behind the clown makeup, that's terrifying. Again, can't say enough about this guy. Huge fan of his work, and I was just thrilled that he was such a sweet dude and very practical and very collaborative and willing to give you know, other people credit. It's just an amazing guy. So let's talk to Vince.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Gilligan. So you spend a lot of time in my hometown. I grew up in Albuquerque.
Yes, you did, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
And you went to high school in at Highland High.
Highland
school,
High.
And we shot a really memorable Breaking Bad scene in Highland High.
You did?
We did.
Which one? I've seen all the Breaking Bads.
Right on. There was a scene at the beginning of season 3, and in it, Walt is in his high school. He's still teaching there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's in the gym, and he's full of people in the gym.
That was the gym?
Yeah, that was the gym.
That's why I didn't recognize it. I don't think I ever set foot in there.
Oh, okay.
In the gym. I think maybe I went to one assembly. Yeah. Certainly no sporting in my past.
Me neither.
But it's really bizarre. Bizarre to me, because I had Cranston in here, and it was one of the biggest regrets of my career as an interviewer, that I was so nervous and I was so wanting to talk to Walter White, I think, for most of the interview. I thought in
right.
my mind that, but for some reason, once we got talking, he was intimidating to me, which he shouldn't be, because he's a very polite,
very sweet guy.
Yeah, sweet guy. Yeah. I didn't mention Albuquerque once.
Oh, yeah?
Okay. So, yeah, and I knew he had a house there, and I grew up there. We could have bonded personally. Blew it.
Yeah.
Why? Well, let's go back to like who you are, because you know I'm a huge fan of Breaking Bad. I'm a huge fan of Better Call Saul. I love Bob, and I've known him for years.
Oh, yeah,
And you know, Breaking Bad is one of those experiences you have. Like, you know, it's one of those things you turn people onto it, like you would turn them onto meth if you were into meth. You know, like, what do you mean you haven't watched Breaking Bad? What the fuck, dude? You gotta try it, man. You gotta fucking try it.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that.
Well, they're not gonna get out.
Thank you for proselytizing.
Yeah. Anybody who starts gets through, anyone who watches 2 or 3 episodes of that and doesn't get hooked, like, I don't need to talk to that guy. Who the fuck needs that guy?
I love it. But I
can't say the same about The X-Files.
Right, okay.
And I know you come from The X-Files.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know why I never watched it, because I'm a fan of conspiracies more than sci-fi.
Sure, sure.
But I never locked in. I guess I could. I mean, I've watched a couple.
You know, it. Sometimes timing counts for a lot, too. Sometimes you come to something at a point in your life and you're into it, and you might not have been into it a little bit earlier or a little bit later. Or maybe it's just not your thing.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Virginia. I was born in Richmond. And then I lived for a big chunk of my formative years in a little town called Farmville, which is 65 miles west of Richmond.
Really?
And it might as well be named Mayberry, right? It's
really?
Named Farmville. Yeah.
And how old are you?
I am now 48.
All right. So do you have siblings?
I have a brother, Patrick. My brother
is
Patrick.
He older?
He's 4 years younger than.
Oh,
me.
Younger. So yeah. You're the oldest.
I'm the oldest of the two of us.
Yeah. It was on you.
Yeah.
To be the guy, to be the leader. Where'd you lead that kid?
I led him into a very different life than I didn't lead him anywhere.
Oh, really?
He was his own boss. And he's a wonderful brother, but we're very different.
What's his thing?
He's just a great guy who's now a father, and I am not a father. So now for the first time at age, like she's about age 46,
yeah.
For me, I became an uncle for the first time.
That's
which
exciting.
Is wonderful. My brother, Pat, and his lovely wife, Miho, have a little daughter named Maya.
Aww.
And she is so cute. It's so wonderful spending time with the three of them and with her.
And you got, that's nice. And now yeah. You gotta, now they did it. So you can go have time with the kid and leave.
Yeah, it's really been a grandpa or something. You get to spoil them and then, yeah.
Are your folks still around?
Both my folks are still around. They're back in Virginia still. And I'm lucky to have them around.
Generations in Virginia. Like, you go back in Virginia? Or you don't really know?
I guess, I always wonder. I see those commercials for like Ancestry.com
right.
and stuff. Do you ever?
No, because I don't know how far, like I know the Jewish thing, you're only one or two generations back and then you're in Russia, Poland,
okay.
or,
yeah, right.
or Germany. You know, that's it. Eastern European. I'm kind of curious.
I am too, but I haven't actually gone and done it. And like if my mom, especially my mom, if she's when she'll listen to this, she'll say, you know all this, and I know my grandfather, and
yeah.
both grandfathers, but yeah, going back many generations, I don't know about that, but
the South is like the South though, like you know, I've become more fascinated with the South,
yeah.
Like, I used to be sort of snotty about the South.
Yeah.
A little condescending.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I go there, out of all the places I visit in the country,
yeah.
it's the most interesting. Like, it just feels good. Like there's a lot of weird history here.
Well,
there's some bad shit went down, but there's some good people here.
Yeah.
It's a moral struggle every day in the South.
Well,
of some kind. What was it like growing up for you there? I mean, did you feel that?
It was great. I love Virginia. I love my home state. I don't get back often enough now. I only get back once a year.
Did you grow up with horses or anything?
I mean, I grew up around them and cows mostly.
Cows?
More cows than horses. It was called Farmville, and it was aptly named.
Oh.
But they weren't. None of them were ours. We grew up in a little a subdivision. You know.
Oh, yeah. How'd you end up there?
Well, my mom was from Virginia.
But in Farmville, like it seemed like you were in Richmond.
Yes, we were in Richmond. My dad met my mom in Richmond, and he was from Syracuse, New York. So my dad's side of the
Yankee.
Family was from, upstate. Mm. And the first thing, you know, when my my grandparents on my dad's side, they moved to Richmond in like 1957, 56 or 57. And they got there because... they wanted my grandfather, Vincent, who I'm partly named after.
Partly?
Well, I'm George Vincent Gilligan Jr., so my dad is George, so I'm a junior. But my grandfather had worked at a GM subdivision, I think.
Yeah. Making car parts?
Making car parts, and he wanted to be his own boss, and
right.
he had the opportunity in the late 50s to buy a used bookstore in
really?
Richmond, Virginia, which he had never visited before. So in the late 50s, he bought this through, it was the back of an ad in a book dealer magazine.
That was the big idea?
It was a big idea, and he was wonderful at it, and he was his own boss until he passed away from the late 50s till he passed away in the late 80s.
He kept a used bookstore?
Yeah, in Richmond, and the first thing they did, and so they moved, he and my grandmother, his wife, Jean, that they moved, and my dad went with them. My dad was about 17 or 18 and was, I think, just about to go into the Marine Corps.
Uh-huh.
But they moved to Richmond from Syracuse, and the first thing they did was put a big Confederate flag up in the window of the new bookstore, because not because they believed in that or anything,
right.
but because they were afraid, you know, this must be a town where that will be important to
right,
do.
Right, so then we're from up north.
Yeah.
We just want to know that we want to sell some books here.
We're not carpetbaggers.
Right.
We want you to know that. So
how long did that stay in the window?
Probably not too long, because they realized most folks were like, whatever, man.
Yeah. I think most folks would be like, what kind of bookstore is that?
Yeah, right. Well, it was, Richmond was different in the late 50s.
Was it?
I mean, from what I hear, I was not around myself.
So we had the used bookstore for 30 years?
40? At least from about...
What was it called? People probably knew it.
Richmond Bookshop, and it's still there, and the old sign is still up.
Was he a character? Do people know him? Like, do you run into people who are like, I know that bookstore?
He was very well respected by the folks who knew him. He was a wonderful guy. He wasn't really a character per se.
Right.
I guess, I mean, he wasn't colorful in a character-y sort of sense, but he was a wonderful bedrock kind of a guy.
Did you have experiences in that bookstore?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it gave me a great love of reading. My brother and I, you know, growing up and visiting, driving in or being driven in from Farmville on an hour and a half drive, and then staying the weekends with my grandparents in Richmond and visiting the bookstore. And my grandfather never really had two dimes to rub together because he didn't make a lot of money, but he made a living.
Right.
He made a living doing this.
Did he have a lot of good books?
He had wonderful books, and I got into science fiction, and I got into... In his bookstore, and he was great because he would... my brother Patrick and I would go around and pile up books and say, Grampy, can we have... We call him Grampy.
Yeah.
Grampy. Grampy, can we have this one? Yeah, sure. Grampy,
Take
can
it.
We have that one? Only occasionally it'd be some really expensive book, and he'd say, well, you know, how about you just read that here, but not take it with you? He was wonderful. He was so generous, and we got to love, Patrick and I both got to love a reading from that.
And you had a relationship with your grandfather.
Yeah, wonderful.
What was some of that first, so sci-fi was your thing?
Comic books, except not the cool kind that everybody makes movies about now.
What do we mean?
Richie Rich. That was what I was into. Richie Rich. All the Harvey comic books.
So that must be these are the seeds of Breaking Bad. Richie Rich.
Richie Rich was born rich. Yeah. He didn't have to work for it like Walter White did. But,
You liked Richie Rich?
He was conflicted about being rich.
First start to sort of realize that, you know, because like to gravitate towards... And even like I don't know how you got the job on X-Files, but you must have some sense of science fiction, you know, and you must have some love for that kind of you know, abstract imagination that's sort of rooted in humanness.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, I grew up loving Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov.
Those are like classic used books. Did you get those at the store?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And read my first. Frank Herbert and who else? I mean, you know, I read. I did not read as deeply. I read very broad and very broadly and very shallowly. Is that shallowly? Is that
sure.
a word? Yeah, but
why not?
But you know what? When I started on X-Files, I mean, I was writing for the movies before that, and I considered myself a comedy writer. I consider myself a writer of comedic movies.
Well, I believe, and I said it from early on, that Walter and Jesse were a comedy team.
You know what? They were sort of the postmodern Laurel and Hardy, weren't they?
Well, there was definitely, I thought that element was definitely there.
Yeah.
And I don't know, we can talk about it in a bit about, you know, how much of that was sort of planned. But, you know, there were, you know, Walter White was a classic straight man.
Yeah. Yeah.
To Jesse.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there's definitely funny shit in there.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there's stuff that's horrible, but it was one of those weird lessons, I think, that I might have learned while watching Breaking Bad, is that there is, when you know, as terrifying as Danny Trejo's head on a tortoise might be, it's fucking hilarious.
Yeah.
I mean, it's on some weird level.
Oh, yeah. No, we made the show as funny as we could possibly make it, and funny, of course, as we both well know, is in the eye of the beholder, but a lot of stuff that made us laugh hysterically in the room didn't necessarily make everybody laugh who was watching, but a lot of stuff made us laugh, and we tried to make it as funny as we could, because we always figured, if this thing is just a downer, if it's just about a guy dying of cancer and he's cooking his nasty drug and making money off that, it's just, you're just going to want to open a vein watching this thing. You're just going to be like, oh, this is not entertaining.
Yeah.
I want to laugh. You got to leaven your drama with humor, with comedy.
Sure.
Because that's, you know, that's the only way you get through life. You got to leaven the real drama of your
buffer,
life.
Buffer disappointment. That's what life is.
Yeah.
Buffering disappointment.
Yes, exactly. So we felt that way from the get-go on Breaking Bad. I just figured this show has a possibility of being so relentlessly heavy and dreary.
The comedy was strong.
Good, yeah, well, good. I'm glad.
Because
good.
Even like, you know, even the characters that were the most frightening in a way we're outside of Gus, but like Tuco is kind of a clown.
Yeah.
In a way.
Yeah.
You know, it,
as long as you're not there for him to cut your head off. Yeah. He's
no, I know.
But, he's funny from a distance. He is.
But even, even in Saul, where you meet Tuco, he's like kind of half a moron.
Yeah.
You know, like, and there's.
No, you're right. Yeah.
That moment where he's like, what should I do? You know, and then the smart guy's got to sort of tell him.
Yeah.
But okay. But going back. So what started the interest in movies? Like how old were you? Like what kind of kid were you in high school? Were you Dungeons and Dragons?
Yeah, played Dungeons and Dragons. I was just a loser and didn't go to the prom.
I don't know. I don't know if that's a loser anymore. I think that is the backstory. That's a proud backstory now, Vince.
Then I was born too soon. Because believe me, man, it was back then. It was being a loser.
Nerds run the world now.
They do.
The sadness has transcended. Like you, a guy who comes from Dungeons and Dragons and Isaac Asimov books, and sitting alone reading in your grandpa's bookstore, created one of the most gritty television series ever. One of the best. Look at what you did.
Richie Rich was a gritty comic book. What can I tell you?
I never did the Dungeons and Dragons thing. I read some Richie Rich.
Yeah, did you? Did you?
Sure. I mean, maybe a little bit.
Casper the Friendly Ghost.
Well, I mean, how old were you? I hope you were young,
I was
right?
17.
No.
I'm just kidding. I was eight or ten or seven or eight.
So you're hanging out with the dungeon masters and.
Yes.
And those kids playing chess, I imagine.
No, I did not. I was not smart. I'm not smart enough for chess. Although Tom Schnau, one of our writer producers, has two or three chess boards going in the office.
Really?
And all the other, not all of them, but my assistant Jen and my former assistant is now one of my writers, Gordon. These folks play chess, and Tom has multiple games going. He's like Bobby Fischer or
that
something.
That guy.
Yeah, and it's just
God,
like,
I wish I could do that with my brain.
I want to knock that board over every time I walk past it.
I think you should. You're the boss.
Take
some liberty. I hear you're too nice a guy in the writer's room.
Yeah, you
it's
know,
time to lose your shit.
I know, I need to lose my shit a
Pull
little.
A Harmon or a Milch.
Yeah.
Fucking... Come on, guy. You need your rite of passage.
Yeah.
And you send some writers crying.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm going to go do that.
Yeah, do it tomorrow. Fuck it all up, Vince. It's time to ruin the whole thing.
That's right.
So, but in high school, did you play a band instrument?
No, I wish I had. You know, my mom is wonderful. I wish, she's going to kill me too when she hears this, I wish she had made me take, and it's not on her, but right. I wish someone had made me take lessons because I love music, but I am not, I you know, in the editing room, I said this before, and it bears repeating, but in the editing room, it's the closest I feel I'll ever get to being able to write music.
Sure.
It's that rhythm of editing is, and I feel like in another lifetime, if I had learned to play some sort of instrument, I wouldn't have been wonderful at it. I wouldn't have been good enough to, I sort of know intrinsically, I wouldn't have been good enough to perform publicly, but it could have given me a grounding that I could have written music, because I think I would have loved to have done that.
Right. But I think what you're saying is that you, because of the medium you've chosen, which is film, really, and because I think that what you did with television, you know, in the tradition of what had been happening in television, The Sopranos, Deadwood, and what that, you know, finding the time and the sort of vision to create, you know, framing and take, you know, a certain amount of time to create filmic things.
Oh,
you know,
thank you. Yeah.
That and also the way that sound works in Breaking Bad. I think that with film you get to integrate all that. Even if you have a guy, it's like you got a musician you work with, or you've got a composer. Right. So so you're still the guy that goes like, could you give me more of that? You know, like
I want more treble. More treble.
Is it just treble, or can you make that? Do you have a more menacing bit of notes?
You know, I always feel like an idiot. We have this amazing composer, Dave Porter, who was on both shows, Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And I always feel like I'm talking to a brain surgeon. Like, could you cut here instead of cut there?
Right.
Could you resect this part instead of? I don't have the language, but you know what works? He's a wonderful down to earth guy, and what works with him and Thomas Goljubich, our music supervisor, works with both those guys, is to speak. And they taught me this: speak in terms simply of emotion. What emotion are you trying to convey here?
In the picture. Yeah.
Instead of, you know, I want this in four-fifths time and blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
I want an A sharp here.
Right.
I couldn't do that to save my life. But with those guys, I talk emotion. And
that's good.
Yeah. And it works well.
Well, yeah. So you're making music on some level? You're making decisions?
It's as close to music as I will ever make, and it feels good to do it.
All right. So you're mad at your mom because she didn't make you play some instruments.
Didn't make me learn to play the piano or something.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Well, you'll just have to let that go, and she's going to feel terrible.
I know.
But she'll call you and go, like, start now, Vince.
I know. Well, she will. And that's what you were exactly. She will say, it's no time like the present. And then you're not dead yet. What's stopping you?
Right.
And she'd be right.
Now, your parents together or not together?
No, not together. They got divorced when I was 10 and my brother was 6 back in 1976.
Did they get along after that, though?
I'm sure they would. They just don't see much of each other.
But they did the right thing by you guys.
You know, it probably didn't feel that way at the time, but yeah, I think they did. Well, they did the right thing for each other, and therefore it was the right thing for us.
But you saw your dad, and you know.
Yeah, and the good thing is, still see my dad, still see my mom, I'm lucky to still have him.
And then
I got my Uncle Gary. He's the other family we have, who's a great guy, and he's in Virginia. So it's one fell swoop. I get to visit all of them.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, knock it all out in one. Kids, see your brother, see mom and dad.
Well, no, actually, Patrick and his wife, Miho, and my niece are out here. They're down in Garden Grove.
Oh, so they all live here.
Yeah, which is even better.
It becomes less important to go back to Virginia.
Well, no, you know, I love going back. I just only really, you know, it takes forever to get there. It's like, because, you know, it takes a flight to Atlanta and then a flight to Richmond, and it takes all day. And I don't
on a little plane.
Well, it depends. Sometimes, but I
do those a lot.
Yeah.
I don't. Sometimes it bothers me. Sometimes they don't. Sometimes I'm like, oh, good. I can see the ground. I feel like I'm in a car.
Oh, okay.
Like I feel like I'm flying. Like I get that. Like there's sometimes I feel better to know. I don't like it when I'm on a plane and you just sort of all of a sudden you're like, I forgot I was flying until we hit this turbulence.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you're like, oh, okay. We're a mile in the air. I remember now. Yeah. God damn it.
Are you a nervous flyer? Do you not like?
Flying? I can't afford to be because it's exhausting, but innately, like I know the odds are in my favor, but you know, there is that possibility.
See, I'm not nervous about dying in the air, I'm nervous about being surrounded by, you know, going through TSA and taking my shoes off and go all this stuff, and then you just never know who you're going to get sitting next to you, and then the seats get smaller every month, you know.
You know what? I'm going to tell you something, I'm going to tell you a secret. You know, you're at a point in your life now where you can go ahead and get first class.
You know what? It was not that long ago that I started doing that.
No,
because it's the goddamn, it's the principle of the thing. It's like how you say you say to yourself, yeah, you know, I got the money, I'm gonna be first class, business class.
Right.
And then you punch it up on the computer
and you're like,
it's like eight fucking times how much
is it really worth it?
It's insane how much more it is.
Believe me, I know. Yeah. But like I don't have a wife, I'm not complaining. Yeah. You know, I don't spend much money.
Yeah.
But now, like, if I'm going all the way coast to coast, I'm like, why not think about it in terms of a guy that can afford it?
Yeah.
See, we both come from a sort of like I come from a comics background, you know, so I'm always like, I don't know when my money's going to go away.
Yeah.
And you come from pretty much working class background, right?
Yeah.
So it just seems like an extravagance.
It, you know what it is, though? It really is a principle thing. I don't understand the pricing, the tiered
pricing. No, there's no pricing. It's just ripping you off.
Yeah, they are.
Right, we've gotten far away from our agenda here.
Yeah.
I think we're good on the airline.
I think the people need to know this.
Yes, I think we're good. We know where you stand airline-wise.
Okay, fair enough. Burbank's not so bad.
No, Burbank's the best.
Yeah, as far as airports.
I fucking love it. Yeah. It's like you can get there a half hour before without even freaking out.
That's an old school pre-9/11 type.
Yeah.
Type.
You can valet your car.
Wow.
They have that. You just pull up.
That's right, they do.
I mean, it's like 20 a day, but who cares?
Oh, no, it's worth it.
For 3 days, 4 days?
Do you remember this is even before, this is like 20, 30 years ago. Remember you could get on the plane with your friend, and then
they'd come get your tickets.
Well, they would say, they'd come on the intercom, and they'd say, okay, everybody who's not actually going to Jacksonville,
Mississippi. Or they could walk you to the gate, but sit on the plane
with you.
You
could literally go on the plane. People listening to this who didn't live through it are going to be like, what? You could get on the plane, and at a certain point, the flight attendant, they call them stewardesses back then.
Sorry.
She would get on and she would say, usually she, and she would say, okay, everybody who's not going to Buffalo,
get off.
Better get off the plane now. It was like, It was such
we
a different
smoke.
World.
I smoked on planes when I was in high school. I used to love smoking on planes. Yeah. You'd have the back four, the back two rows. Yeah. I don't know. On a plane now, could you imagine? Like, what the fuck? How different was the world then? Everything must have smelled like cigarettes.
Because
if someone lit a cigarette on an airplane right now, it'd be like, what is happening?
The air marshal would just shoot you in the head before
the
plane even landed.
The smell. Like, everyone was so acclimated to the smell, I guess, because every plane had it.
Oh, yeah. And I had a sixth grade teacher in elementary school. Wonderful, wonderful teacher. Mr. Guthrie. I loved him. Great teacher.
Yeah.
He smoked a pipe. Yeah. In class, and it smelled so good.
The best.
They would take him away and just summarily shoot him against a wall now for doing that. We loved it. It smelled good.
Did you smoke?
No, I didn't.
Never
I didn't.
Did.
Pipes do smell better than cigarettes. Cigarettes are nasty.
Yeah. Cigars and pipes, I like.
I smoke the occasional cigar.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, I like that.
It's
one
good.
Couple times a year.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
The good ones?
But it's like.
Sony
it's,
cigars?
I'm happy just with the flying on the occasional Sony jet ride.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, it's just cigarettes. So, yeah.
Bad. They're bad.
My brother and my mom used to smoke. And you're right. We'd be in that little living room we had, and they'd both be smoking away.
Yeah.
And I didn't even notice. And now it would bother me now.
It would drive everyone crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was everywhere.
Yeah.
So, all right. So now you're playing Dungeons and Dragons. You're not smoking. You're not playing any instruments. You're reading Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov.
Yeah.
You know, where does the interest... In where did your creativity start?
You know,
was
I
it
just,
in film? Was it in?
I loved doing. I had a rich imagination, and it's held me in pretty good stead. I was lucky. I loved. I had a wonderful art teacher named Jackie Wall.
This the best, was an
elementary
important.
School. She was a wonderful, and her son is. Two-time Oscar-winning editor Angus Wall, who won for editing, co-editing, Social Network and Girl with the Dragon Tattoo? Anyway, he cuts for Fincher, and he and his editing
this guy
partner.
You grew up with.
And this grew up in the town of Farmville, which had like 4,500 people.
And his mom was your art teacher.
And his mom was my art teacher. He's a wonderful guy. She was... a wonderful teacher, and I loved drawing, painting, sculpting, and she turned us on to so many of the things. We got to make little pewter sculptures, and we got to fire stuff in the kiln that she had, and she was a wonderful teacher.
Did you do brass? Did you do any of that stuff?
I did some of that later. I went to a school
with the wax, and then you put it in the thing, and it melts out
the
wax.
The lost wax process. I made a pair of silver earrings
at a
school called Interlochen, which was great.
Where the hell's that?
That's in Interlochen, Michigan, right near Traverse City. I went there 1 year. It was ninth grade. It was and Mrs. Wall helped me get into that. That was after elementary school.
So what is that, like an exchange program?
It was a boarding. It still exists. It's an excellent boarding school. National Music Camp's there in the summer, and then during the school months, it's Interlochen Arts Academy. And
what else did you do there?
Again, didn't date girls. The list of what I didn't do was longer and
but
sadder.
But you tried sculpting. You tried. You drew. You painted.
Did metalsmithing. Did blacksmithing. Made some pottery. Painted stuff like that. I was a visual arts student. Most of the kids there were music and performance arts students. And
so you're always heading that way. Like
I kind of always was. I was always headed in.
Thank God for Mrs. Wall.
Yeah. Yeah. And she, you know, but I always, I just always was into that stuff. And I always, that's what I was doing all through high school, being a nerd. I was writing scripts, and I was making little
for movies? Film.
Yeah, little short films on Super 8 film.
You made them? You had a Super 8 camera?
I didn't have one. That's yet another wonderful thing about her is she loaned me hers every summer, so I got to keep it for 3 months over the summer.
Like with the little reels, like film.
Yeah, a little Super 8 film, yeah. Film.
And you were cutting it too? You had an editor?
Yeah, I would cut it. She let me use the janitor at the school. It was called the J.P. Wynn Campus School in Farmville, Virginia. It doesn't exist anymore. It was a great, great school. And she let me use a janitor's closet as an editing room.
Huh.
And she lent me her editing machine, and I would cut the Super 8 film. And it was
what were those for early films? What were those early Vince Gilligan films?
I did the one that was my magnum opus for elementary school. It was called Space Wreck.
Uh-huh.
And my brother Pat starred in it, and he is in a spaceship, which I had so much fun building.
Yeah.
And
how'd you build it?
It was a little foot long or less than a foot.
Oh, so you're using effects.
And I shot it against a piece of black fabric with little grains of salt glued on it for stars. Mm-hmm. It looked like shit.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't poke holes and put a light source behind it.
No, because
it.
That would have been too smart. That would have looked too good.
Yeah.
You know, I had to do it the harder and crappier looking way. But, and my brother's in the spaceship and he lands on a planet and then he finds the wreckage of a ship and he's checking it out and some weird space slime has eaten through this other ship and made it crash.
Uh-huh.
So he has to take off in a hurry to avoid it. But then you see, dun, 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 to the bottom of the ship as it lifts off. There's slime all over the bottom.
Oh, he's in trouble.
Yeah, he's in trouble.
And that's it?
Yeah, that was it.
That's pretty dark. Doesn't work out for that guy.
No, it didn't.
That's pretty ambitious for a Super 8 film.
If you saw it, you wouldn't think so.
Well, you decided that you had the capacity to go to another planet.
Yeah, that's true. That's
true. Like on film, you're like, we're doing full on sci-fi.
That's true.
Yeah,
that's true.
And what were some of the other ones? Do you remember?
I was made something with a little stop motion gremlin who was giving trouble to some guy.
Yeah,
stuff like that. That was called Gremlin.
Oh, good name.
Yeah.
You didn't get anything.
It was actually before Gremlins.
Oh, so maybe you should
I should have sued those bastards.
Yeah, Joe Dante shouldn't hear about that. Who wrote that.
It was Joe Dante.
Yeah, that first Gremlins movie's good.
He has the coolest office, as I recall. I had a meeting with him years ago. I could have hung around that office for days.
Oh, really?
Filled with props from his movies and other famous movies.
Yeah.
Awesome office.
Yeah, good eye, that guy.
Yeah, good director.
So you do these different schools, you're in the arts, and when did you sort of realize it was film that it was going to be?
I love movies. My dad, George, senior, he would wake me up. This was way before VHS tape and obviously way before DVRs and all that. And the late movie would be on, at 2 a.m. He'd wake me up and he'd say, hey, come on, wake up. You got to watch this. We got to watch Bad Day at Black Rock.
Really?
What's that? Oh, it's a great movie. You got to watch it. Spencer Tracy's this one-armed guy, and he's just come from the war. And he said, watch him karate chop this guy in the throat. This guy named Ernest Borgnine.
Yeah.
He just, watch him chop this guy in the throat. It's great.
Yeah.
It was that kind of thing.
So it was a regular occurrence where he'd wake you up and have you watch these great movies?
Probably only a couple times, but I have such a fond memory of that. And he turned me on to these great movies.
What other ones?
What else?
Westerns?
Westerns. The spaghetti westerns, the John Ford westerns, sure. The Searchers.
The Searchers, right?
Searchers, great.
Because I realized that, there are shots that you got.
Oh, yeah.
In Albuquerque, outside Albuquerque.
Oh, yeah.
So you're thinking that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It dawned on me when I directed the pilot of Breaking Bad.
Yeah.
I was ripping off William Friedkin a bit from The French Connection, which is another one of my favorite movies.
What part?
The steady, but nonetheless handheld camera.
Right.
The French Connection is shot with the cinema verite, this sort of newsreel.
Right.
Way of it's as if someone's running around following Popeye Doyle,
right.
And he doesn't have time to set up a tripod, so everything has to be handheld.
Right.
But it's not this caffeinated handheld that's moving artificially. It's someone holding the camera as steady as they humanly can, but they're still breathing to it.
Did that.
I was ripping off Friedkin there, and I was doing that because when I was doing the pilot,
the scene where we see him naked.
Well, actually, throughout the whole series, really,
you did a lot of that.
That steady.
But you were aware of that. You're like,
I was thinking of Friedkin and The French Connection.
Where'd you learn that he did that?
Just from watching the movie. I mean, just when you watch it, and I've seen it a bunch of times. It's one of my favorites. But when you watch French Connection, you sort of notice that.
I watched it again recently. It holds up, man.
Oh, it's a great movie. And it, you know what? It feels like it could have been made today. It's one of those kind of movies.
Yeah.
It's great. But my point being, when I wrote the pilot for Breaking Bad, I was thinking of California. I was thinking of shooting it here in California. And one of the luckiest happenstances, aside from getting the yes from Sony and AMC in the first place, was when the Sony guy said, what do you think about shooting it instead of California? What do you think about shooting in Albuquerque, New Mexico? And I said, why? And they said, because New Mexico has this wonderful rebate, this tax incentive.
And they got this. Did you use those studios out there?
Well, yeah. We shoot at Q Studios right near the airport.
Yeah.
And they're great, too. But they said, you will have more money at your disposal that you can put on film. And I said, I thought about it. And they said, and you can still make it California. Just put California license plates on the cars. And I said, no, we'll do it, but we'll make it Albuquerque because, unfortunately, there's a meth problem everywhere, pretty much all of the 50 states.
But you get the great landscape.
And so this is what I'm heading toward. Yeah. It was such a wonderful stroke of good fortune among many others because directing the pilot, like I say, I'm thinking of the French Connection, but I'm looking around halfway through the pilot saying, this looks like a Western. Yeah. This is a Western landscape. I can think of John Ford. I can think of Sergio Leone. I can think of Bud Bedeker and all these wonderful, all the Howard Hawks, all the guys directing these wonderful Westerns. We can make this a modern Western. And that's exactly what we did. And we got to a point, Michelle McLaren, who was our producer-director and directed more episodes of Breaking Bad than anyone else. She and I would show, we would show the first 15 minutes of Once Upon a Time in the West to all incoming directors.
Yeah.
And say, we're kind of looking for this kind of a look, you know.
You did?
Oh, yeah, we did. We were very much going for a Western at that point.
At what point? Right at the beginning.
Well, I mean,
you evolve. You realize.
I guess what I'm saying, I was thinking more of, like I say, thinking more of Friedkin and then realizing, my God, look at these endless skies with these beautiful white puffy clouds.
You shot it beautifully.
Well, we had amazing DPs, starting with John Toll, double Oscar winner, shot the pilot, and then we had Ray Villalobos, excellent DP for the first season, and then Michael Slovis for the remainder of the series.
They must have loved the opportunity to shoot out there.
They did, and they got to. I mean, when we started, film was still was not rare like it is now. But we shot film too, 35mm film, all the way to the end of Breaking Bad, and that was another. Now that's a fading opportunity.
It's all shot on film.
Every bit of Breaking Bad. Well, yes, the show's shot on film. We had a couple shots here and there we did with little video cameras just to grab.
So that's how you got the depth, I guess, and the richness. What was the primary difference outside of being you're beholden to nailing it a little more consistently?
Oh, well, yeah, you don't have that. You don't have that monitor that shows you exactly what you're
right. You
get.
Can't just sort of like, yeah, it's video. We can shoot as much as we want. It's video. Yeah, it's not. Yeah. It's just a chip. It's a card.
Well, when we started in 2007, video. I mean, video HD video certainly existed. It didn't seem like as much of a good idea at the time. I mean, guys,
they didn't
like,
have the Red camera. They didn't have it, like any of those high end.
I don't know if the Red existed then or not, but and guys like Michael Mann were shooting Collateral and Miami Vice and stuff like the movie on HD.
But it was still like a big deal. Like, we're trying this out.
Yeah, it was a little more. I may be getting my history wrong. Maybe it was a little less experimental than I recall. But it never occurred to me to do that.
You're always going to go shoot on film.
And honestly, to the point that Peter Gould and I, Peter's my partner on Better Call Saul, and he was a writer-producer on Breaking Bad, we are a bit heartsick that we're not shooting film on Better Call Saul. We're shooting on the Red. We're shooting on the Red Dragon. Yeah. And we miss film. And the Red Dragon looks great. And it's one of many cameras. The F-55 by Sony looks great. But the Alexa by Arri. But we miss film.
Why?
You know, I don't have a great reason for you other than I miss the history of it. I miss, when I think of film, I think of all the wonderful movies that made me interested in this medium in the first place. They were all shot on film. It just has a romance to it. It has a lot of people will tell you it has a look that video can't replicate. I hate to say this, being such a lover of film as I am, but we had a very detailed test we took before Better Call Saul. We shot Arthur Albert, our DP on Better Call Saul, shot footage on 35mm film, the F-55, the couple of the Reds, the Alexa, and then we had a blind taste test, as it were. He showed us all this footage, had it all color timed to look similar and whatnot. Showed us all this footage and I figured if I could pick out the film, if Peter and I could pick out the film, we'd shoot film, even at the cost of, you know, $100,000 more an episode, which is what they tell us we're saving, more or less.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it, we couldn't pick it out. Couldn't pick out the film. So,
damn.
And I felt so
heartbreaking.
So all of this long-winded way of saying, when you say to me, what do you miss about film? I can't say that video is inferior. I can't even say that it's fundamentally different at this point,
right,
in its look.
Right.
I can just say that I miss film. I miss it, and I still want to be shooting on it. But I can't sit here and tell you why it's better. But
you miss you can feel it.
Yeah, it's a palpable thing. I miss, it's, of course, you know, no one has cut on film for quite a while. They've been, you know.
So you just immediately transfer?
Well, I mean, we always cut on the Avid, and even on X-Files back in the mid-90s, we were cutting on the Avid. So,
you were shooting on film with that?
We shot a film on that, but we cut on the Avid. So a lot of guys, you know, the guys, the real proponents of video, the guys like George Lucas, had an interesting conversation. The one time I ever met him, I had an interesting conversation with him. Someone told him who I was, and he said, Breaking Bad, I hear that's good. And then my boss, Steve Mosco, runs Sony Television. He said, hey, George, you know, Vince, and he knew he was stirring up the shit when he said this. He said, George, you know, Vince shoots Breaking Bad on film. And he turned around at his heel and came back, and he said, why would you do that? And he was like angry. Like, why would you shoot on film? Why would you?
Yeah.
You know, video's so much better. And it,
what'd you say?
I just listened because I'm like, it was just cool talking to George Lucas.
Being yelled at by George Lucas.
Yeah, I was getting yelled. I mean, I'm overstating it a little bit. He was pleasant about it. He wasn't angry, but he was proselytizing to someone who he could pull out of the depths of ignorance and show the light to, you know.
Sure.
And he's right when he says this. He says, you know, when these guys say this, they say if you're capturing photochemically, which is to say on film, and you're immediately transferring the negative into ones and zeros and cutting on it and finishing on it, what's the point? Unless you're doing unless the production chain, post production chain, is photochemical from start to finish, and that's a good argument. You know, I don't have good arguments to the George
Lucas. You just
Lucas
like it.
It's like I just like it.
It's like me listening to records. I don't know why I went back to that. It's sort of a trend.
Yeah.
But who the hell knows if it's better?
There's a certain grain crawl, I guess, that film has, because it's the grain in video is in the grain, as it were, the pixel locations are in the same spot with every frame. And in film, it's always crawling because the grain, which is to say the crystal structure, is different in a different spot on every frame. So there's that. But, you know, these guys will say, well, if you want that look, you can burn that into the, you can bake that into the video, you know. And,
we could do that.
You know, so.
Can add it.
It's like, yeah, but it's just not as romantic.
I know. You wanted to be Howard Hawks.
Yeah. You didn't want to be.
William Friedkin.
Yeah.
The big camera.
Yeah.
Sure, man.
Yeah, you know.
You know, queer, check the gate.
Yeah, check the gate. Well, we still say that.
Sure.
And then every time I say it, because you'll say, okay, that was great, check the gate. And then I'm like, why am I even still saying that?
it's nostalgia.
Yeah.
So your dad showed you all these movies and got you 11 movies. Did you end up going to school for film?
Yeah. And my mom, I can't leave her out. She was so, a bit more than my dad, in fact, was very supportive of me going to film school.
Mm-hmm.
My dad did say, as I recall, why don't you just be an electrician?
Well, they get nervous.
And I don't blame them. You know, I'd be nervous for my kid if I had one. You know.
Right. You know, that's usually what it is. Like, I've never met... Like, every time a parent who has a creative kid says something like that, they don't know any better. They just all they hear is like, no, not going to make a living doing that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's interesting.
Which, in his world, people did.
What'd he do?
My dad was an insurance claims adjuster, and my mom was a school teacher, reading teacher in elementary school, and they were both supportive. I don't mean to make it sound like he wasn't, but my mom was more supportive of me going to film school and went to NYU undergrad.
The good one.
Yeah, it was a good school. Went to undergrad, never went past undergrad, but it was.
But you got it. The Tisch School?
Tisch School of the Arts. Yeah.
But you learned how to shoot and cut.
I learned how to shoot and cut. I mean, I'd been doing that in high school, but I learned a lot more than I already knew, and I learned how to, you know, got to shoot 16mm for the first time. And when I was there from 85 to 89, it was still film, and I'm really glad I didn't miss out on that. Although we also had a video class, we shot Beta 2 or whatever it was at the time, but we got to shoot film, and that was great.
So how'd you get the gig on, what was the first gig out of college? Did you make movies in college?
Made little, you know, mostly crude on other people's movies, made little forgettable student films and whatnot myself.
Sci-fi, did you do
no,
better
no sci-fi? I did something, my thesis film was called Mime Pays. It was, get it? Crime Pays,
yeah,
Mime Pays.
Right. Good one. Okay, so you are a comedian.
And it was,
yeah.
And it was,
Yeah, there you go.
And it was these three street clowns who get pissed off at this mime for snaking business from their corner where they panhandle.
So you wanted to do comedy.
I did. I really did. No, I thought of myself as a comedy person. I mean, the sci-fi early on, but I really thought of myself when I got into my 20s as someone who wrote movie scripts. And that's what I did. I wrote the first feature-length movie scripts I wrote were comedic. I wrote a script called Home Fries as my thesis screenplay.
Yeah.
At NYU, my final year, and I was lucky enough to sell it, and it got made a couple years later with Drew Barrymore and Luke Wilson and.
I don't remember that movie.
It was I wrote it in '89. I won a screenwriting contest in my home state of Virginia with it. And one of the judges of the contest was a guy named Mark Johnson, who had just produced Rain Man.
Oh, yeah.
And he was an alumnus of UVA where the contest was held. And he contacted me after, and this was in late 89 or early 90. He said, "Hey, I like that script that you wrote. Do you have any others?" And thank God I did at that point.
Yeah.
And cut to like 1998. I guess it was about 9 years later. He produced it, and it got made, and they shot it down outside of Austin, Texas, and it was Drew Barrymore, Luke Wilson, Jake Busey, Catherine O'Hara.
Yeah.
And it's two brothers who are really wrapped around their mother's finger, and they murder their stepfather at the behest of their mother. But
dark comedy.
Dark, very dark, because the murder, it opens with this murder. They scare their stepfather to death. They fly a Huey Cobra for the Army National Guard,
yeah.
And they scare him to death by chasing him around through the woods with this helicopter and shooting blanks at him. And so the cops find him dead of a heart attack, and so it looks like the perfect crime, except that it sounds so goddamn stupid pitching it now in hindsight. But Drew Barrymore was in her booth at the fast food restaurant,
yeah,
with her headset on, and she overheard the whole thing. And she happened to be the woman who was having an affair with the older man who gets murdered. And when you pitch it, it sounds so ridiculously convoluted. It's fun though.
Did it do well?
No, it didn't do well, but it was well made. The actors were wonderful, and the guy who directed it, a guy named Dean Pariseau, did an excellent job. Any failings of this movie were strictly on the part of the screenwriter.
Oh, you so take the hit.
Yeah, no, I'm taking the hit because it's, you know.
And did that get you to L.A.?
That winning that contest got me. It didn't get me to L.A., honestly. It got me a career, which I fulfilled from Virginia. I moved back from NYU a year out of college, moved back to Virginia, bought a house, and had a girlfriend back in Virginia. I love the idea of living in Virginia and owning a house. Could I get own a house there?
You going to get married soon?
We've been together 25 years, but right. Yeah, we're still kicking the tires. You know.
All right.
Her name is Holly.
Okay.
And she's wonderful, but you know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
All right. Yeah.
But you know, I was dating her, and I bought a house and all that, and I was writing movie scripts in Virginia, and then going to Kinko's and photocopying them and putting them in a FedEx shipper and shipping them out. This is before.
Sure.
You know, the internet and all that, or before I knew how to use it.
And were you selling them?
Yeah, and Mark Johnson on the other end, he'd get them in the mail, and I think I sold the first two or three, or he sold for me the first two or three to TriStar.
Yeah.
And the first one to get made actually was something called Wilder Napalm, which I guarantee you've never heard of.
No.
That was Dennis Quaid and Deborah Winger and Arliss Howard.
Damn.
Two brothers again.
Yeah.
This is like my blue period or something,
sure.
My brother period. But two brothers who are in love with the same woman, and they can start fires with their minds.
Oh, good. A little sci-fi action.
Yeah, a little sci-fi.
A lot of fire.
Yeah, a lot of fire. Yeah, exactly. But that got made. So I was living in Virginia for the first 5 years of my career and making money in Hollywood. And I thought, you know, I was like, it was great. It was a good deal.
Yeah.
But the movie writing started to dry up. At that point, about 5 years in, started.
How many got made?
At the point things started to dry up, only one had been made, which is Wilder Napalm. That was 93.
Oh, okay. So yeah. Other one came later.
Yeah, yeah.
But how many movies have you had made that you've written total?
With my name on them, three. The third one being, so Wilder Napalm, Home Fries, and the third one being Hancock, which uh-huh. I, which I, I, A writer named Vi Vincent Ngo wrote the first draft of that, did a great job. And then I was sort of hired to...
Wait, was that the Will Smith?
Will Smith, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Will Smith as a superhero.
That was pretty good.
It was a big credit, yeah.
The reluctant superhero. He'd given it up, or he's homeless. And
kind of homeless, drunk superhero.
Yeah. That was pretty good.
Will Smith has got great charisma, so he could read a phone book and make it interesting.
So it starts drying up, and you're like, TV.
You know what? Yes, exactly, because things are drying up. I lost my Writers Guild insurance.
That's the worst. When you go on Cobra, you're paying for your insurance.
Well, like an idiot, I didn't even go on Cobra. I just sort of said, you know what? I'm just gonna take a risk
roll
here.
Roll the dice.
Yeah, roll the dice. Yeah. Still in my early 20s at that point, but I wouldn't roll the dice now, that's for sure. But anyway, then the show called The X-Files came along in 93.
And you loved it?
I loved it as a fan. I didn't have anything to do with it the first 2 years. I was just a fan. I just loved it.
Yeah.
And I called my agent. My agent at the time, she retired since then, but she was my agent until she retired, a woman named Rhonda Gomez. And I said, I was just talking to her a bit, talking movie business.
Yeah.
You know, when am I coming out again? You know, is there another meeting for me, this and that and the other? And I said, by the way, there's this new show called The X-Files. It had been on maybe 6 months at that point. I said, you really ought to watch it. It's great. And she said, well, as luck would have it, I'm related to the creator of it by marriage. Uh-huh. I am related by marriage. Some convoluted fashion, she was related to Chris Carter's wife, Dory.
Uh-huh.
And Rhonda, my agent, said, I'll get you a meeting with him next time you're out on movie business, if you'd like. And I said, that'd be great. Not to pitch to him, just to shake his hand and tell him, I love your show. That's literally all I wanted to do.
Uh-huh.
And one thing led to another, and they were really desperate for writers at that point.
Really?
Season two.
Yeah.
Because they had to do 26 episodes in season two, and they needed help. And I was just at the right place at the right time. And Chris Carter gave me this job, which is the second greatest job I've ever had, which was, and a close second at that, which was writing and producing, being a producer, learning to produce, learning to direct, and learning to write, really, on television for The X-Files. So it was like the best film school ever, and they paid me to be there.
And how many episodes did you end up doing?
I mean, the show did 202 episodes over 9 years. I was there for about six and a half. No, I was there 7 years out of the nine. I can't even tell you how many I had a hand in. I mean, because I sort of, my thing toward the end was rewriting scripts and then writing my own originals. And I can't even remember how many.
But you directed, you wrote.
I directed two
produced.
Of them.
Produced. Just two.
Just two as far as directing. But the first time I ever got to direct professionally was for The X-Files.
Someone threw you a bone. They're like, all right, let the kid do it.
Yeah, well, you know, I and Chris was a great boss because he let us all take on as much responsibility as we could handle. And I learned so much. I can't say enough good about that job. And I wish I had a hand in the upcoming reboot that he's doing for Fox. They're doing six new episodes this coming year.
Why don't you have a hand in it?
I just don't have the time. And it breaks my
Were
heart
you
to
asked?
Say that. I was asked.
Yeah.
And I had a wonderful lunch with Chris, and he said, you want to be a part of this? And I said, and it just broke my heart. I said, man, I want to. I got Better Call Saul going. And I'm not a multitasker. I haven't figured out how to do that.
Well, it's hard.
It's hard. Because,
you know, something's going to suffer sometimes.
Yeah.
Unless, I don't know how people do it.
I don't know.
Now.
Well, you're multitasking. You got this great podcast. You got your own show.
It's exhausting.
I bet it is.
Like, you don't, you know, it kind of shreds your brain a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, your responsibilities, I think, are a little larger, but you know what? Maybe not.
You're the boss, man.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's tough.
It's exhausting. Yeah, it is.
And also, you know, you have I have to be honest with you, you have a bigger budget than I do.
Well, yeah, but budget, what does budget mean? Budget is actually makes things easier, not harder. I mean, if you have less of a budget and
you
still got to get it done.
Well, you want a little more time. Yeah, maybe a little more time.
Time is money, money's
time. A little
time.
More time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's what it really comes down
to. That's what it comes down to for
me. Because, like,
too.
If I'm doing my show, like, you know, I'm writing and I'm producing and I'm in every scene.
Yeah.
So we got to have the writing done before we start shooting.
Yeah.
And then it's like, then it's just like in it.
Yeah.
And we're shooting two episodes in 6 days. They're like,
Jesus.
It's crazy, dude.
Holy crap.
It's crazy.
I don't know how you do it.
I don't either.
That's insane.
It's a little insane.
That's good for, my hat is off to you.
Yeah. Well, but the problem is if you pull it off, the network's like, great. You can do it like that. Yeah. Well, we've hit gold.
Yeah. Do 3 in 7 days now.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
So you met Cranston on the set of X-Files?
I met Cranston. I wrote an episode. It was called Drive, and it was the beginning of season, I don't even remember. But it was when we first moved the production from Vancouver to California. Mm-hmm. And I had this part I'd written where Agent Mulder had to be stuck in a car with this crazy guy who's threatening to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
And the part was tricky because he needed to be a real scary, badass guy.
Yeah.
But at the end of the hour, you had to feel sorry for him when he died. And we had all these scary actors come in who could pull off the scary,
right,
but they couldn't pull off the human part where you felt bad for him
until, right.
And we were scared because we were nervous because it was like only a few days before it was going to start shooting. And this guy, Bryan Cranston, walks in. And it was just like this weight lifted off of us as soon as he read.
Really?
Because he was so good. This was like 99.
Yeah.
And he, I said, my God, that guy. As soon as he walked out the door, I said, off to wardrobe. OTW.
Yeah.
I said, this guy is the guy. And everybody in the room, all the other producers said, yeah, he was the guy. He's the guy. And I never forgot him. He was wonderful in this role. I had forgot him. And I said, even as the shoot was progressing for that episode, and you got to understand, we worked with a lot of great actors on X-Files, but I never had that eureka experience of saying, I want to work with this guy again in the future.
Right.
I mean, there's plenty of people I would want to work with again,
right,
but I never had that experience of, I've got to find something for this particular guy.
Right.
Like I had with him.
Yeah.
And a year and a half later, after that episode airs, I'm seeing commercials on Fox for this new show called Malcolm in the Middle. And I see this clean-shaven guy I didn't recognize, and I'm like, that guy looks familiar. And then I realize, oh, my God, it's that guy from my Drive episode, X-Files. And I'm watching, and I swear to God, my first reaction, I think I said it out loud to no one.
Yeah.
I was alone in the room. I said, I didn't know he could be funny.
Yeah.
Because all I knew him as was this dramatic guy.
Yeah.
This really intense, dramatic
guy. He's a real actor.
He's a real, and that's the first way I knew him, because when we started pitching actors, when I pitched, well, there was only one actor as far as I was concerned. When I pitched to AMC, they said, who do you want to play Walter White? I said, Bryan Cranston. The folks at AMC, all they knew him from was Malcolm in the Middle.
Yeah.
And they said, seriously?
Yeah.
And to their credit, once I showed them this X-File episode, they had the opposite take on him I had. They said, wait a minute, this guy could be serious. He could be dramatic. Uh-huh. I only thought he could be funny.
Uh-huh.
But he's the whole package. He could do it all.
So where was the idea born? I mean, because like the thing that fascinates me, like as we get into these, you know, what you're doing now and Breaking Bad, was that, you know, the landscape and the storyscape of this idea seems simple on one level. But, you know, the thing that made it so compelling outside of the facts of the story was that you really didn't know what the fuck was going to happen after every episode. Yeah. Like, every episode, like, was this, well, before we get to that agenda, how did you come up with this idea? What was the kernel of it?
You know, I'm sure
you've been asked that before.
Well, no, and it's cool. It's just, I do get asked, I wish I had a more satisfying answer. I don't know where the idea came from. I just know the minute it hit me. I remember distinctly. I was talking to my buddy, Tom Schnauz, I'd mentioned earlier, who I had met when we were both going to NYU film school.
Right.
And he wrote for a spinoff series of the X-Files we had called The Lone Gunman, and he wrote for a little bit for the X-Files. And this was like 2004, 2 years after the X-Files ended. And he and I were talking on the phone saying, you know, you got any work lately?
Yeah.
Any writing work? No. How about you? Nah, nothing in the offing, nothing in the pipeline. What are we going to do, man? We're not fit for anything else.
Yeah.
Any other kind of work. And he, apropos of nothing, he was just mentioning something he had read in the New York Times about someone who built a meth lab in an apartment and made some kids sick.
Uh-huh.
And he said, well, we could put a meth lab in an RV, drive around and make meth, see the sights, make some money.
Yeah.
He said that.
Yeah.
And of course, every time I tell this story, everyone who hears it says, wait a minute, how come he wasn't the creator of Breaking Bad?
Right.
But I, as soon as he was pitching this, he was basically saying, why don't we do that? Why don't we drive around America and cook meth? And he was joking, of course. But soon as he said that, I just had this eureka moment where I was like, because I was thinking of a straight arrow guy doing this, because I was picturing me doing this. And when I say straight arrow, I mean it in the most boring, most boring, scared of authority sense. But that would describe Tom and I, or especially, I shouldn't speak for him, describes me, you know, a law-abiding citizen. Why would I actually do that?
Right.
That intrigues me to think, is there a situation in which I would actually do that?
Yeah.
And then I thought, well, if I had to make money for my family, I might. And if I had a grounding in chemistry and had a real pressing financial need because I was, say, dying of cancer, and it was like it hit like a thunderbolt. It was like boom, you know. Yeah. And that was the moment it hit. Now, where it came from, in hindsight being 2020, I was about to turn 40 years old. And I was already thinking, man, what kind of midlife crisis am I going to have? It's probably going to be a bad one, since I never really sowed any wild oats to begin with.
Right.
How crazy am I going to go here? And luckily for me, I got to go crazy by proxy by writing this guy for 6 years. You know, this guy Walter White.
How does a character like that, you know, evolve though, in the sense that because like the you know one of the pivotal dynamics was his pride and his his very personal resentment against his former partner.
All of that juicy meaty center of the character came later. This is the great thing about TV, and I never get tired of talking about what a wonderfully collaborative medium as you well know, and as we both know, it's like, for instance, I mean, the Walter White of the pilot of Breaking Bad, and that was the only time I ever worked on this character completely by myself. I came up with this character, and he was somewhat schematic, somewhat mechanical, in that he was basically a good guy who needed money for his family because he was dying of cancer. It was as simple as that.
Right.
And there was a little bit in there about him being somewhat jealous of his brother-in-law's hail fellow well met abilities and somewhat resentful of those, and so there's a little bit of that as extra fuel as to why he would cook meth, his DEA
brother-in-law,
DEA agent brother-in-law. There was a little extra fuel for the engine, dramatically speaking.
But you didn't have the backdrop of the
I didn't have him being a prideful man. I didn't have him
walking away from.
Yeah, and one of the best moments. And then once I had these wonderful writers around me and this amazing actor playing Walter White, Bryan Cranston, that collaborative nature of the medium starts to kick in, and ideas start percolating that I would have never had by myself in a million years.
Of course.
And one of the most important moments was the fourth episode of that first season, because what I had come up with was rather schematic and was going to quickly, I could see the writing on the wall. It was quickly going to, we'd be in danger of, okay, he makes $40,000 this week. Next week he makes $60,000. But, you know, two steps forward, one step back. Maybe someone steals his money. Okay, so now he's got to make another $80,000. And very schematic.
Like no moral struggle.
No struggle.
Just, no Nietzschean Superman.
Yeah, and in the fourth episode, it dawned on us as a group. We said to ourselves, is this enough for a guy just to, yeah, I don't really love cooking meth, but I got to make the money. But crows stole my money and flew off and made a nest with it. Now I got to make more money or whatever, you know, all that schematic stuff. What's really at this guy's heart? And we had this idea that it only came from this collaborative beast that is the TV storytelling process, which was so wonderful. We came up with this moment where we introduce these two characters who are rich and good looking and run their own company. And they used to work with Walt years ago, and they find out he's dying of cancer, and they say, oh my God, this is terrible. We're going to pay for your cancer treatment. We're going to give you a job with us, no strings attached. We love you, Walt. We care about you. And he says, no, thank you. And he goes off and he cooks meth again.
But that was just the basics of it. You didn't have the backstory.
No, we didn't have any of
that. That he was responsible for the company's success.
know that. Yeah, we had just and the truth is, if you watch Breaking Bad again very closely, the fascinating sociological thing about the characters, these two rich characters, Gretchen and Elliot, if you watch the show very closely, they do nothing wrong. And yet, for pretty much to a man and a woman, to every viewer who's ever watched Breaking Bad, sees them as villains, as bad guys who
pushed him out,
who pushed him out, left him in the cold, stole his ideas, stole his patents. You know,
so you don't know why he left.
Well, you get very clearly from him that he feels wronged and abused.
Right.
But if you watch very closely, they never. It can be very easily, if you're open-minded to it, it can very easily be interpreted as that was his hang-up.
Right.
They didn't do anything wrong. There's an episode much later in the run of the series where he sits down with this woman, and you realize they used to be a couple.
Oh, so
they used to date.
That's right.
And something happened between them, and her interpretation of events is vastly different than his. And we believe the sociologically interesting thing about this is he's our hero, come what may. No matter that he watches a young woman choke to death on her own vomit, no matter that he poisons a young boy with Lily of the Valley, no matter what this guy does, we go with him.
It's interesting. At some point, I was like, that's the trick here.
Yeah.
Is that this guy should not be winning.
No, he shouldn't.
And you know, but you can't help but root for him because he's got cancer and he's so fucking smart.
Yeah.
And you know, he's like, you know, he's his own guy who outsmarts everybody.
Yeah.
But it's funny, you know, all the way right up to the end, there's plenty of people. Cause like at some point I started sympathizing with Hank.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which is you're supposed to.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and there is no, as far as I'm.
But they're both prideful.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It became sort of a weird moral study of everybody.
And I wish I'd love to sit here and take credit for. Oh, yeah, I knew it'd be like this. And we got so lucky along the way. It was such a lightning in a bottle kind of a situation.
Great writers.
Well, we had great writers. We had great actors. And I was blessed with these great writers and actors and directors and everyone was pulling the rope in the same direction. But even with all of that, I couldn't have guessed Walter White would remain so sympathizable for people. I because in a weird way, perversely, I was trying to shake people off in the early going. I was saying, I wonder how bad we can make this guy before everybody just tunes out and then the show ends and then I'll find another show to do. And lo and behold, I lost sympathy for Walter White before most viewers did.
If some people stayed with him the whole way through.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's a testament to how stable Cranston is in his work.
Well, it goes back to that first thing I ever cast him in, that X-File episode. I needed a guy who could be villainous and mean and nasty, and yet when he died, you had to have sympathy for the devil.
Right.
You had to
Satan.
Feel sorry for
You're right.
him.
Yeah.
And he pulled that off.
He could
and
do
I,
it.
I saw that in him. We all saw it in him in that early audition. And he was there was no other guy who could have played this.
Yeah. Now the other question I have about the work of it. I mean, how much, because I always wonder this, having, you know, just finished the third season of my own show.
Yeah.
Like, I always assume that I'm doing something wrong, even though I'm working with guys, in terms of, like, should I know what every season's supposed to happen? Do you have a Bible for the entire?
No. If it makes you feel any better.
So you didn't know the whole arc of the series?
No, and let me tell you, people who know the whole arc for the series, and by the way, there's no one way to do this job, which is simultaneously what's wonderful about it and what's scary and maddening about it is there's no one way to do it. And there are folks who say, I know the ending of my series. If they'll let me do it, I know season one, season two, there's going to be this thing in season three, and then here's how it all ends. And for me, if that works for you, go with God. That's wonderful. But for me, if I knew, I never thought I knew, but even if I thought I knew, that has the potential. That's a risky downside to that is there's going to be a better idea that comes along because invariably they do. Some writer, some actor, somebody, some director is going to throw an idea your way and it's going to be better, but you're not going to be open to it because you're going to have blinders on and you're going to say, no, but see, I already know how season five
the vision,
ends.
Yeah.
I got the vision. So there were times, plenty of times, I wish we knew further ahead than we did, but we really were making it up as we went along. And great things came from that because we were very rigorous about consistency, most importantly, consistency.
Visual consistency?
Every emotional consistency, first and foremost.
Well, how'd you cast Aaron Paul?
Aaron Paul, I knew I wanted Brian in this role, but all the other actors came from Bialy and Thomas. Sharon Bialy and Sherry Thomas are casting folks. They brought in Aaron Paul, for instance. And I was talking to Aaron in the audition, and suddenly I realized he had been in an X-File. I didn't realize that. Uh-huh. It was an X-File my friend Tom Schnauz wrote a few years before that. And he's a bit of a chameleon, too, so I hadn't even recognized him. But that was Bialy and Thomas who found him. And he came in and he auditioned. A couple years ago, he said to me, "Do you remember how bad that audition was?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "You remember I flubbed my lines so bad I had to start over?" I said, "No, you didn't do that." Because he's a wonderful actor and a sweet guy who's tough on himself sometimes. I said, "You're just being tough on yourself. You didn't flub the lines." And he said, "I'm telling you, I did." And I said, no, my friend, you didn't. And then someone showed me the tape, and damned if he wasn't right. He flubs his lines so terribly in the audition. And I didn't even remember that because he was electric in this audition. He was the guy. And it didn't matter remotely to me that he didn't get the lines right.
Do you hear that, actors?
And it's true.
Yeah.
You know, the tough thing, my hat is off to all actors. I've never done it. I couldn't. I mean, not in any way that counts, and I couldn't do it for a living. And it's such a tough job, and it takes so much out of you, I got to think. And it takes so much willingness to risk defeat and risk rejection. And so much of it is, the trouble is, I as a producer, I usually know when the actor walks in the door before they even open their mouth if they're right for the part.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, the reason to keep going in for those auditions from a layperson's, from a producer's point of view, from a non-acting producer's point of view, the reason to keep doing it is that guys like me, men and women like producers like me, in my position, we very often, we love someone, we instantly know they're wrong for the role at hand, but we love them nonetheless, and we file them away. And we say, as when they walk out the door, we say to the casting folks, "Completely wrong for this role, but please put an asterisk by that name, and I want to see them again in the future if we have thus and so."
Right.
And that, you know, and that's the reason, one of the many reasons to keep putting yourself out there.
Now, was Aaron Paul, was the plan to keep him? I mean, like, because...
No, originally, I was going to kill him. Rather, the part of Jesse, I was going to kill the character off at the end of the first season. And this is one of those, you know, this is an interesting, back to the last question you asked me. Did I know the ending of season one, for instance? I thought I did. This is a great example of being open to better ideas, because I thought I knew that at the end of season one, the character Jesse should die. Having fulfilled his purpose of getting...
Teaching him how to do this job,
he would get killed horribly. And Walt, that would propel us into season two, because Walt would say, would feel guilty, and he would feel angry at the guys who murdered his former student, and he would get revenge, and that would be an engine of drama for season two. But as soon as we had Aaron Paul, he was so good.
The two of them. I mean,
and the chemistry, no pun intended, between the two of them, was so outstanding that I would have been a fool to kill off this character. I would have been biting off my nose to spite my face, you know.
I thought it was a pretty beautiful bit of cinema at the very end when you showed Aaron, how it ended up for Aaron.
Good. Well, thank you.
You know, because I've met guys like that.
Yeah.
You meet guys where, you know, because I'm a recovery guy, so, you know, you hear these stories, horrible stories.
Yeah.
And then they're sort of like, "Well, yeah, now I just do this job," and they live this life, and it's, and you can go on.
Yeah.
And
you
can, you know, you can put it behind you.
Yeah.
That was a beautiful beat.
I'm so glad. It came from, as much as anything, it came from our love for Aaron and our love for the character of Jesse. And Jesse would not have been as lovely a character if not for Aaron.
Right.
This is, yet again, the collaborative nature of this job is that, you know, someone else playing him would have had a different path and a different ending. Someone who wasn't as sweet of spirit and as lovely a person as Aaron Paul would have become a different character and might have been killed off sooner and might have been. But we fundamentally wanted him to survive. We, meaning the writers.
Yeah, he's the only one.
Yeah, and we talked about him getting killed because everything was on the table. Everything was possible in those final days, final weeks and months in the writer's room. But we realized we just wanted to see him get away.
Yeah.
And ride off into the sunset, such as it was.
That was the ending.
Yeah, for him. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the ending of the series.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The last thing you see, right?
Last time you see him. Yeah, yeah.
So, well, genius stuff. Oh, and I like that you give so much credit to everybody involved. It was just a mind-blowing experience that I miss. I miss it.
Thank you. I miss it, too. I miss it, too.
So what compelled you to build a series around that character, Saul?
Bob.
I do, but is it a comedy?
It's, it's, I thought it was... Well, you know what? The best way of putting it is Breaking Bad. I thought it was a drama with a little bit of comedy in it.
Yeah.
When we started this, Peter Gould and I thought Better Call Saul would be the flip of it. We thought it'd be a comedy with a little bit of drama. There's actually much more drama. Just like there was much more comedy to Breaking Bad than I ever would have guessed, there was much more drama to Better Call Saul than I ever would have guessed. But the genesis of it stemmed from loving working with... And I should say, I was about to say, it's loving working with Bob Odenkirk, and that is true, but that in and of itself doesn't answer the question because I love working with Aaron Paul. I love working with, Betsy Brand and Dean Norris and Anna Gunn and R.J. Mitty. Any of them I want to work with in the future.
Mm-hmm.
But also with the character of Saul Goodman, he is fun to generate dialogue for.
Yeah.
He has such a gift of gab that most of us don't possess, and it's fun putting those words in his mouth. That was part of the fun of it and part of the interest in it initially.
And also this is someone who becomes morally challenged and somehow, compromises himself and has to justify that.
Yeah. Although having said that, we had so little, I'm embarrassed to say how little understanding we had of Saul Goodman when we started talking about doing a spinoff series.
Uh-huh.
We didn't realize that he was a nice guy and somewhat heroic, in fact, in his past. We didn't know any of that about him.
You discovered that.
We discovered it as we went, as a group of writers, but with Bob's help as an actor portraying the character.
Well, it's great, man. You're off to a good start. I'm excited about the second season.
Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
So you're writing that now?
We are halfway through episode 5 out of 10 episodes, breaking the story. And the writers of those episodes are plugging away. And we'll be shooting through the summer and into the fall.
Okay. Well, if you need me in Albuquerque for a bit part, you let me know.
Anytime you're in town, please let us know. We would love to have you come visit. We'd love to put you on the show.
Okay.
I'll
do it.
Do you get back? Do you get back to Albuquerque?
Yeah. Yeah, my dad's there. When we're getting along, I go back.
All right.
Yeah, yeah. I'll come out. I'll plan my trip around when you're shooting and be like, hey, Vince, I'm coming down for as long as you need me.
Right on, man. We would love that. We'd be honored.
I'd love to work with Bob. That'd be a blast.
He's great.
And thanks for taking time from the writing process to do this. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Great guy, right? Right? Was I lying? Love it. What a great conversation. Okay. Yeah. WTFpod.com for that merch and the dates and everything else. Some of you missed my guitar playing. I found that very touching. So let's do it.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Moin, wir sind die Footballerei. Ich bin Kutsche.
Ich bin Flo.
Und ich bin Daniel.
Wir sind aber noch viele mehr. In der Footballerei gibt es American Football Freischnauze, überwiegend die NFL, in ganz vielen verschiedenen Formaten. Da ist für alle was dabei.
Das Frühstücksei zum Beispiel gibt es jeden Montag ab 5 Uhr als Podcast. In der Saison natürlich mit den ersten Reaktionen auf die Spiele des Wochenendes und in der Offseason versorgen wir dich hier mit allen frischen News aus dem NFL-Kosmos.
Dazu gibt es die bunte Welt der NFL in Kutsches Zirkus, hochspannende Kriminalfälle bei Hall of Crime und das Thema der Woche während der Saison in der Footballerei. Show.
Also, wenn dich American Football fasziniert, wirst du die große Auswahl in der Footballerei lieben. Wir freuen uns auf dich.